Welcome to Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle. I'm Bobby Osinski, and this is a show all about music, music production, and the music business. My guest this week is producer and engineer Gareth Jones. First of all, there's been a rise in fake artists. Yeah, streaming gives way to a lot of ways that an artist can really be someone else. This can come in a number of different ways. A really big thing when it comes to fake artists are playlist aliases. You may not realize this is happening, but there may be recommendations for you to go check out a particular artist that maybe you never heard of before, but that artist is actually another one. So what ends up happening is it's a fake artist on the playlist that gets pointed back to someone else. This is happening more and more, and obviously it's really upsetting consumers. Then there's something called Vocaloids, and this is a software-synthesized voice. It's AI-driven. It's a crowdsourced artist. It's not real, but in fact, it is for all intents and purposes. There's actually someone like that out there right now, an artist called Hatsune Miku. Yes, it's a Vocaloid, and there are more and more like that popping up. Another thing that's happening is holograms. Now, not so much the holograms that we see in concert, but these are online holograms that basically conjure up a virtual influencer. In other words, it's a social media CGI character, CGI meaning computer graphics. Yes, there's already one that's very popular, Little Makila. So all these things are happening, and we're seeing that it's changing our consumer patterns. First of all, the recommendations that we're getting, and second of all, it's revolving around the actual music and artists that we're consuming. So just be aware that the new artist or the new influencer that you might be digging may not be real at all. If you have any questions or comments, you can send them to questions@bobbyosinski.com. Don't forget about my online courses on mixing, production, branding, and music business success at bobbyosinskicourses.com. Also, get an expert analysis and objective opinion of your songs and mixes as a member of my Hitmakers Club. Go to hitmakersclub.com to learn more. Now, for a really long time, engineers who grew up in the analog world could not get used to digital. There were all sorts of complaints. There were all sorts of pushback from these engineers that just never felt that the sound was good enough. This has all changed in the last few years for a number of reasons. The biggest reason is that the digital audio workstations are a whole lot better. They do more. They feel more analog-like, and they can sound pretty darn close to analog. Same thing goes for plugins. Plugins used to be a facsimile of what the hardware was. It was sort of in the ballpark, but not quite there. Now it's really, really close. So much so that the differences aren't even worth the effort of pulling the hardware out to use it. The interfaces are better. Even the cheapest interface sounds a whole lot better than the most expensive one of 10 years ago. So right off the bat, going into the digital world and coming out of the digital world, you're getting a much better conversion, and therefore it's a lot better sounding. Better work surfaces. Now we have analog-like work surfaces. So if you really want to push faders and turn knobs, it's certainly there for you at just about any price you can think of. A really big part of why classic analog mixers feel comfortable in the box is there's a lot more experience. These days, we know how to drive digital. Surprisingly enough, if you drive it more like analog, it actually works a whole lot better. And now that everyone's figured that out, now we're finding that there's a lot less pushback for doing something in the box. On the other hand, there are many engineers that like a hybrid mixing situation. So the dedicated summing boxes are out there again at all different price ranges, all different types of sounds if you want it. And if you feel you want that analog sound, it's certainly there for you to get it. Perhaps the biggest thing, though, is client acceptance. These days, clients know how easy it is for you to make changes, and they demand those changes to be made if you're doing a mix for someone. So you can no longer rely on going back to all your analog gear, resetting it up, and having it come back a little wrong, because doing it in the box, we can get instant recalls in no time at all, and that's what clients really want. Now, that also goes hand in hand with the budgets. These days, budgets are small enough that just about every engineer, every major mix engineer, has a studio in their home. And the whole idea is basically, you have enough money that you can pay me or you can pay a studio. Well, we'll just go to my studio and I'll throw that in. So now it's become the norm that the budgets are small enough in most cases, unless you're an A-list artist, that now you have to watch your money, and it's a whole lot easier to do that in our digital domain today. So you're finding that there's less pushback from even the classic engineers these days when it comes to mixing in the box. Of course, if you grew up mixing in the box, you really don't know the difference, so you're pretty comfortable already. Either way, it's a good time to be in the music business when it comes to digital audio. My guest this week is producer and engineer Gareth Jones, who's a pioneer in the use of cutting-edge digital equipment, sampling technology, and synthesizers. He produced 5 albums for techno innovators Depeche Mode, 6 albums for synth-pop superstars Erasure, and many more. As the mixer of John Fox's seminal album, Metamatic, he realized that an artist could truly define his sound with electronics. Then, as co-producer of many of Depeche Mode's greatest works, he helped to create experimental music with global chart appeal. During the interview, we talked about taking advantage of unforeseen opportunities, his love of modular synthesis, life on the bleeding edge of technology, the appeal of Logic Pro, and much more. I spoke with Gareth from a studio that he was working at in France. Tell me about how you got started in the business.
I got started in the business. I got started with loads of passion, but no idea what to do. I tried to get a placement at a recording studio by writing letters to the studios, which obviously doesn't really work. And then I managed to get a job as a junior kind of sound engineer at the BBC, which is our national state broadcaster, which was fantastic. I'm a huge fan of public service broadcasting anyway. And I learned one end of a microphone from another kind of thing. Got some very bad. And then I realized fairly quickly that they were going to only let me work on music in about 10 years. So, that's the kind of career path. And so I started doing moonlighting. I managed to get a break. A wonderful guy called Mike Finesilver, who was, I believe, he was certainly a musician, possibly a bass player and a producer himself, had a tiny little 8-track, obviously analog, 1-inch analog studio. And he gave me a break, really. He allowed me to come in and do some sessions. And that was really my start of my... Then I felt when that happened, I felt I'd arrived, because I really wanted to be making music I wanted to be recording music and working with bands and stuff. And so this was great. So for about 6 months, I did the radio job and the studio job kind of in my time off, and then became apparent that I could get, make a living, if you like, out of the freelance 8-track work. So I left the radio station and devoted myself full time to the little 8-track studio, where I learned a hell of a lot. Actually, I mean, I'm kind of my trajectory has been learning from the bands and the musicians that I've been able to work with. I didn't have the trajectory where I was able to be an assistant in a grand studio where I could learn from all the great gurus, you know, engineers and producers. It was much more working with bands, and occasionally a producer came in. It was a tiny studio, but it had a bit of a reputation and some some people came through and I was working all the time and trying to hone my skills, you know.
Yeah. Well, I'm similar to you. I started on an 8-track, a 1-inch 8-track as well.
Yeah. Yeah. Wonderful format.
Yeah. Yeah. And it was really good training, especially as compared to now where you don't have to worry about many of those problems of tracks. And then you did. So it was a different skill set.
I find that, I mean, hey, everyone has their own journey, right, Bobby? But
yeah.
but for me, the work experience of limited tracks has been like hugely helpful. I'm not, you know, left to my own devices. If when I'm producing or when I'm making my own music, I'm not a 256 track guy. You know, it's just not my skill set. It's not my style. It's not what I'm interested in, really. Obviously, if I'm mixing, it's a different thing. I take what's sent and I do my best to work my way through it. But no, it's a great, you know, analogs. But Brian Eno famously said, didn't he, anyone who romanticizes working on tape hasn't done it.
Yes, so, that's true.
Yeah. I mean, it had its downsides, right?
I like to tell the story that 3 or 4 years ago, I had an artist that insisted on using tape. And it was a miserable experience. And it was for the artist eventually as well, because we'd run out of tracks. It's like, well, let's do another vocal track. Oh, sorry, can't do it.
Yeah.
You know, or the band is hot and you want to do another take, but you have to roll it off and get another reel and they're not
hot
anymore.
Yeah, or decide which tape you're going to erase and so on. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I feel that. That has a certain tension as well that can be productive. But also, obviously, like many of us of my generation, I was a very early adopter with the digital world. Very early, very painful and expensive it was at the beginning. But I love the musical creativity of the computer as well. I feel it's an instrument, one of the instruments that I can be creative on or in. So the arrangement, the instant arrangement possibilities, the wonderful access to different sound, plugins and spaces. It's hugely creative. The record I'm doing right now, the last record I did with my friend, he's a huge analog nut. We did a triple album on analog tape with a band, his band. And it was super fun. And we got there. But this record, I went straight into Logic. My preferred DAW is Logic, doesn't matter. I went straight into Logic Audio, and it's just been a wonderful creative experience, you know.
Well, I want to go into all those subjects in a second, but let's go to when you were in Berlin at Hansa. How did you get there?
I got there, like many things in my life, by luck, really, chance, fluke, whatever. I met through a contact through Tuxedo Moon. I met a German Neue Welle, New Wave, it was called, and the Deutsche Neue Welle band in the early 80s. And I got invited to co-produce an album for them, which we tracked in Vienna. I was young and inexperienced and not very confident. I mean, I felt confident, but inside I wasn't that confident. So I wanted to go back to London to a studio I knew to mix it. And the manager of the band said to me, that's fine, you can do that if you want. But before you do that, come and have a look at this studio in Berlin. Obviously, the band lived in Berlin. The manager was in Berlin. It made more sense for them. So I said, yeah, of course, man. And he took me to show me the Hansa mix room, which at the time was a wonderfully high-tech SSL mix room. And as a young engineer, I'd never worked on solid state, you know, and now I don't care, you know. But back then, it was such a big deal. I walked in, and in about 5 seconds, I said, yep, I'll do it here. Thank you very much, you know.
Yeah.
But it was awesome. I thought, this is my chance to get my hands and ears around a solid-state console. So it was so that's how it started. And then I did another couple of projects there. I fell in love with a wonderful creative musician who I was working with in Berlin at the time. And everything came together. Work. What's the opposite of work?
Play.
home life. What do they call it?
Yeah, yeah, right.
I don't know. There's something for it. But work-life balance. Yeah, work-life all came together. And I thought, okay, what a great opportunity to move to Berlin. I loved the studio. I was in a creative and productive, wonderful relationship. So I kind of bit the bullet and thought, I was late 20s, 27, I think. I thought, if I don't move now, this is an opportunity to move countries. And I felt, if I don't do it now, when am I going to do it? So I moved, and then, you know, the whole thing, I did the legendary Berlin trilogy with Depeche Mode in, we did always finish the records in Berlin. I met my friend Daniel in the studio where he was working with the Birthday Party, and he was the record company boss. And I said, what about mixing Construction Time again in the Hansa mix room? And he came up and had a look and said, yeah, it'd be great. Let's do it. So everything came together, really, but all started by chance. And with, as so often in my life, I resisted it at first, Bobby. I was like, no, I don't want to mix in Berlin. I want to go back to London. And, you know.
Yeah, that's kind of the case. Yeah, anything good that happens by chance, you keep it at arm's length for a second,
I think. Well, I was resistant, but, you know, now I'm much more open to... I've learned to pay attention, and I'm much more open to opportunity, you know, and synchronicity. It's very important to me.
How did you meet Depeche Mode?
Oh, it's another resistant thing. I'd helped an artist I'd met in the 8-track and generated a bit of money, and he was a passionate studio user. This is John Fox from Ultravox. And he wanted to build his own studio because, like many artists, he realized that he was faced with kind of escalating studio bills if he took the time he wanted to make his records. So he built his own studio, and I helped and advised, and as far as I could, I was his engineer at the time. I mean, I look back and I think, well, basically we knew nothing, but we knew enough to build it, you know. And so it was he was a hip electronic musician, kind of minimalist. And Depeche were trying to make their difficult third album, and they were looking for a new studio. The record company, Daniel and the band, were looking for a new studio to work in. And they'd heard about John Fox's studio because he was an electronic musician like them. And they came down to try it out. And John said, you should do this session. It's an interesting band. And I was like, I was a bit of a very alternative guy at the time. I'm still alternative, but I was very locked in my own world at the time. I said, I'm not doing that session, John. That band's on the radio. That's pop music. That's not my thing, you know. And so I turned it down, the demo session where they demoed the studio. And fortunately for me, because I became great friends with Daniel and we're still friends to this day, very close friends, and colleagues, the team loved the studio, but they didn't like the engineer that they'd been assigned. So John came to me again as my mentor, about 5 years older than me, and said, look, you really need to go and talk to these people. It's a cool thing, you know, it's a good label. We'd already heard Warm Leatherette, Daniel's legendary first single on Mute Records. We'd heard it in the studio and it'd blown our minds. So he said, go along and meet them, you know. And of course, once we all met, you know, once I met them all face to face, they were wonderfully energetic and charming and creative individuals, artists, you know, and I felt very comfortable and at home. So again, it's another example, Bobby, of what I'm trying to, something I initially resisted.
You were at the forefront, especially with Depeche, you were at the forefront of everything digital, everything that was cutting edge. And I know how difficult it can be from being on the bleeding edge like that many times. What was your experience?
There were a bunch of us, obviously, out there, you know, all this new gear was arriving. So I can't claim to be the leader of the movement, but there's a bunch of, obviously, everyone was very excited about it. Very painful, actually, some of it was, but hugely creative, obviously. You know, It's only people of my age now can realize what life was like before the sampler. But you know, the sampler was clearly an incredible tool in, you know, with the it made light work of what had taken weeks to do in with tape previously. So we were all very excited by the idea of being able to sample the world and make beats and melodies out of it. But sync was a nightmare. Sync was the early digital sync. It wasn't so much the offset, which we could manage, but it was the jitter. The jitter was like horrific. So, and the, obviously we were kind of discovering this on the fly. So, and we were trying to make tight electronic music. We came from Gates and CVs and 808s that were all very, very precise. Analog driven sync was, for all its limitations, was extremely tight. And the early digital sync was very problematic. Hey, sync's still an issue.
Yeah, it is, yeah.
Even after all these years, it's a thing. Hey, it's a life's work, sync. But, you know, so there were lots of excitement. The excitement far outweighed the challenges, you know. And I was very fortunate to be doing this kind of research work with clients who were also super interested in going down the path. So we had a real opportunity and funding on sessions in the studio to grow together to pursue this, what was then new technology.
Well, speaking of Gates and CV, I understand that you're really into modular synthesis these days.
I've had a renewed my love affair with the analog, with modular. Yeah, I'm like many people, you know, inspired by Dieter Döpfer's using the Eurorack format, partly because it's vaguely affordable. In a way that the vintage modular isn't really affordable for someone like me anymore, and the wonderful boutique manufacturers of Moog and Make Noise and many others, where even if the module goes faulty, we can send it back. I found it. I'm not a guitarist, or I played keyboards for many years very badly. I would never play keyboards to anyone, but I found a kind of home for my channeling of the cosmic musical spirit through the modular synthesis world, so which has been wonderfully liberating and creative for me, and it's something I use in my own music and projects, and obviously something I can bring to production as well, because everyone loves a modular synthesis. Oh, in my world, yeah, everyone loves a modular synthesizer. You know?
It's really easy to go down the rabbit hole because there's so many different modules.
Yeah.
So for you, there must be X amount of basic modules that you always go to.
Well, Bobby, I fell in love with Make Noise for some reason, which is a company based out of Asheville in North Carolina. I partly because when I first looked at the modules that my friend had, I couldn't really understand the legending on them, they have this very idiosyncratic legending. But as I pursued it, I thought, oh, this stuff's really interesting. So my core rack that I can pick up and take out the studio is almost exclusively Make Noise modules, which is I don't know why. So, I mean, I'm working now with my friend Jan, and he's got a massive collection of big modular synth wall, and it's super fun to explore the whole wall. But I think it's like your choice of DAW in a way. It's a very personal aesthetic thing. It doesn't matter. All the DAWs are awesome, and loads of the modular stuff is awesome. But if you find some kind of personal connection, I don't know, I understand from my guitarist friends, they find a special connection sometimes with a particular guitar, and that's how they, if you want, channel musical spirit or express themselves or whatever you want to call it. And in a way, it's the same for me with Make Noise. I just found something that I loved, and I pursued it. And luckily, I'm slightly budget limited, so I can't get everything. So I'm happy to stay in the Make Noise corner.
Yeah. You know?
I haven't mortgaged the house to carry on.
You mentioned Logic. You're a big Logic user. And I'm sure you've worked with most of the DAWs that are available. How did you come to calling that one your main workstation?
Well, I guess it goes way back. I was a big fan of Notator on the Atari. which was a MIDI-only program, obviously. And then when audio became available in the computer, Studio Vision was the company, Opcode and Studio Vision. That was amazing, and that was an amazing sequencer. And I loved it, and because I could get samples of audio. And then I guess I tried what happened was in my little studio in London at some stage. It's very many years ago now, but I was using Cubase very happily. I knew the Cubase programmer, Mark Badger, who's now deceased. Rest in peace, Mark. But at some stage, I hit some kind of problem with something really simple like MIDI machine control of a Fostex or something. And Logic solved the problem. And then I continued in that down that route. I felt a nice connection back to Gerhard Lengeling, who I'd met already in Atari days. And this is way before Apple, obviously. Yeah. When they were still making PC versions of Logic Audio. And somehow, again, it just connected. And it solved two or three problems in my studio, sync, MIDI machine control. Suddenly everything worked. And then I just stuck with it. And that was some stage about 30 years ago. I think I decided I'm like too old to learn any more DAW. I do love Ableton. A lot of my collaborative creative work is my original compositions are done with colleagues who speak Pro Tools and Ableton, and then I speak Logic and Ableton. So Ableton is like a really great common ground where we can both sit down at the DAW and make it rock.
You know what's interesting about Ableton to me is that if you're used to being on a digital audio workstation from the beginning, and then you're presented with Ableton, it's kind of difficult to get your arms around because you're thinking differently about it. So how does that work for you? Because it seemed to work fairly easy for you if you use it a lot.
My breakthrough with Ableton was going to the arrange page and getting out of the loops page. For a long time, I was because the thing about Ableton was it has all these stacks of loops and scenes and shit. For a long time, I wasn't really connecting to Ableton, and because I wasn't really that comfortable. A lot of the music I make is not that loopy. It's not like Tiny Snippets looped. And then I think it was I was doing some kind of lectureship for Red Bull at an academy or something, and I watched the kids, the super young talented people using Ableton, and they were all in the arrange page. And I thought, I can work. And then after that, it was easy because then in the arrange page is like every other arrange page, like Pro Tools or Logic or Cubase, a bit like every other arrange page.
Sure.
So then I was able to dive in and really enjoy it. And almost all the work I do with my colleagues, Nick Hook in Spiritual Friendship and Chris Bono, I have a project with called Naus Alpha. We're always in the arrange page. We're never in the other page, whatever it's called, the loops page. We're always in the arrange page. And that's kind of easy for old school piano scroll music paper guys like me,
Yeah, well, like me too. Okay, so that's a secret.
That was my breakthrough. It was a big breakthrough, Bobby. It's good point, good question. You know, before it was just theoretically interesting. I was like, yeah, whatever, that's quite clever. And I found I made stacks of stuff in Ableton but never finished it. Because I always had all these scenes and loops and shit going, but I never managed to break through to the next stage, you know?
Yeah, yeah. You have mentioned your music a number of times, and I understand you have a new album that just came out. Or is it coming out? Is it out?
Okay, yeah, it came out on the 18th, actually, digital only at the moment.
Okay. So doing new music, and especially an album these days, is an undertaking. What prompted you to do that?
Well, I'd started, after a year, like many producer engineers, I suppose, I can't really speak for other people, but I had loads of unfinished ideas always on my hard drive. And what I about 5 years ago, I started working with my friend Nick Hook, and we made an album by really just by pushing the critic out of the room and saying, look, let's not judge, let's just make something. And we loved it. We both loved it. We had no money, no budget, so we had to be very time efficient. And he's in New York and I'm in London. So when he came over, or when I went over to him, and, you know, time was precious. We'd invested the flights and stuff. So that was a bit of a breakthrough, collaborating, realizing, oh, actually, I can finish stuff. And that's an ongoing project. We're working on a new album now, our fourth album. And partly inspired by seeing him make a solo record and helping a dear friend of mine, Pascal Gabriel, is another producer, made a solo record that I helped him mix at the end. I felt, for some reason, in 2019, I'd said, okay, this year I need to make a solo project myself. I kind of made a contract with myself, and I told a couple of people. I mentioned it to my wife, and I mentioned it to another record company boss friend of mine, and said, oh, just very casually, oh, you know, I'm going to make a, and having kind of made this contract with myself, I felt that's what pushed me to finish, actually, because it's really easy to start anything. I had, as I said, like many people, hundreds of folders of stuff, but I just started afresh. And also the power of the my workflow with the analog modular is because in a lot of us with analog modules, we build a patch. I mean, it gives us back something that we wouldn't have expected. Obviously, we chose the modules, and I bring a lifetime of experience to building the patch. But nevertheless, it's very surprising. It brings the name of my project is Electrogenetic, and I'm trying to reference with the name the idea that the electronics gives birth to some of the ideas. So it was the combination, really, of the power of recording jams, essentially jam sessions with patches that I built, and the personal contract that I made with myself to complete. I would have felt like a real dick, Bobby, if I hadn't made it, you know, if I hadn't complete at the end of the year, if I hadn't done it. It kind of pushed me, you know.
Okay, so one of the problems that newer producers, newer artists have when they're self-producing is the fact that they can never finish. And it's mostly because they get new ideas. Some of it is, well, it's not good enough yet. That being said, you're a pro. You've been doing this for a really long time. So beside the fact that maybe you had a deadline, because a deadline does fix all that, but
it's an imaginary deadline, though, really. I made a deadline up for myself, right?
Yeah. But how did you overcome that?
Well, I decided, as I said, when we started the Spiritual Friendship Project, we decided that we were not going to, that our job was to make the stuff and not judge it. Because if I'm in judgment mode, it's never going to be good enough. You know, there's some, let's face it, there is some pretty awesome music out there in the last 1,000 years. You know, so I put that aside. It's a humble offering from me. The biggest challenge for me, actually, Bobby, was it because it was solo. I didn't have the inspiration and the wonderful soundboard of working with someone else. You know, that was the big challenge. I worked on a number of pieces. I definitely decided to stop judging and just make it anyway, and then whatever, you know, release it. And as for complete, so that the idea of it not being good enough, I'd wrestled with that for 30 years, and it shut me down. And that hadn't really worked for me. So I tried that one. And for 30, 35 years, I never finished anything. So I thought, well, that's not working. So let's forget about it not being good enough. Let's just make the shit and see what happens. And in terms of getting it finished, I guess I just put in the time every now and again. And because I made this commitment, actually, I was a bit blessed. That year was, in terms of commissioned work, was a bit bleak. I mean, I'm a freelancer my whole life. I'm used to it. So in a way, the universe came back to me and said, well, you want time to make your own record? Well, there's not going to be many gigs this year, brother. So that as well was a gift from somewhere, that actually I'm sitting there thinking, well, actually, I've got nothing on for 3 weeks. Well, get down the studio and work on that. And, you know, a lot of things start, all the modular jams I did, I tracked to stereo. So that's a massive commitment already.
Yeah.
So it's either good enough to build on or it's not. It wasn't like every element was stemmed out to a different input. Everything was tracked to stereo. And then I built layers on top of it as I felt, as the spirit moved me. So that was that helped as well, because had the modular sessions been able to be reduced to individual sounds, it might have taken forever. I'm a big, because of my early 8-track background, you know, this commitment, it's kind of suits me, helps me get stuff finished. So then I was able to, I thought, oh, and all the time for me, Bobby, I do like watercolors as well, but at a very enjoyable but very amateurish level. And all the time I find if I make a watercolor and look at it, I think, well, that's rubbish. I might as well just throw it straight in the bin. But if I just close the sketch pad and come back to it 2 days later, I look at it and think, oh, that's not too bad, you know. And then 3 days later, I might have another, oh, I'm really pleased with that. That's really good. Look, do you want to see my watercolor? You know,
yeah.
And it was a bit, I adopted this kind of approach with the music. I'd make something and then I'd put it away. And then I'd come back, might play it like 3 weeks later and think, oh, that stereo gem, that's got something. It's too long, you know, that needs an edit. And then stage by stage, I'd just build it up, you know.
Yeah.
But
yeah,
really, the big thing was killing. My therapist says killing the critic doesn't help. She's a big proponent of negotiating with the critic. She says we need to please leave the room for 4 hours, critic, whilst I just make something. Yeah,
that's good. I like that.
I like it. Yeah,
because we all have that critic, and that's what stops people from finishing.
Yeah, it's as I said, Bobby. You know, it stopped me for many decades.
Yeah.
And I thought, well, enough. This is enough now, isn't it?
When you're mixing, are you mixing solely in the box?
No, I'm the hybrid. I've got in my little shed at Strong Room, I've got a 14 channel Fat Bustard where I've got a little analog chain on it with a Clarophonic EQ and some tweakers, some Clarophonic tweakers. So I've got a little analog summing amp and mix chain, which I love. When I'm mixing with Jan, we're starting tomorrow. We're mixing on a SSL console that in his mix room is. So it's a room full of analog gear. So, which I like too, because it's like my part of my history. Obviously, mixing in the box is awesome. You know, I've written another record with a friend of mine that we're just finishing, where I'm going to stay in the box. Because I've got the feeling the record company are going to want some adjustments later.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So, you know, it's just so efficient. And it sounds awesome in the box. You know, for people of our experience and our musicality, once you gain stage it properly in the box, it's awesome. You know, it's big and wide. I mean, hey, it's not even a question anymore, is it? But, you know, so I'm slightly hybrid for my commissioned work. Unless someone says, hey, let's go to Air and mix on the Montserrat console. Would you like? I'd say, yes, please, you know.
Sure.
But I feel that my work has improved as well because of the mixing in the box, because I like mixing an album. I like to get a good first mix of everything and then being able to go back and then think, oh, God, you know, the bass drum's not loud enough or something, you know. That's just wonderful to get to a sweet spot. I love that. Leaving the client side of it out entirely. Obviously, clients demand that it should be completely recallable. but at a creative level, a personal level, I do feel my mixings, I feel I get to where I need to be better because I can put it away for a couple of days and then come back and go, oh, you know, a bit more reverb on the vocal be nice or whatever, you know.
Yeah.
Which was a big deal before, wasn't it?
Yeah, sure was. Do you have a favorite mixing trick? A technique that maybe you pull out more often than not?
I have the monitors at medium volume all the time now. So I really feel I know where the levels sit. I work on my barefoots, you know, about, say, I don't know, I've got a dB meter on my phone. I used to mix a bit loud, I think, but I kind of have it sitting there about 75. It says about a meter from the monitors, you know, from inspired by the film guys, actually,
yeah.
who do a lot of massive dynamic work. And just having the monitors just sitting there at the same volume all day. I mean, I've got alternate monitors that I reference, but the main monitors just sitting there. I find that very helpful because I feel that I know where the bottom end needs to sit automatically because that's how loud those speakers are, you know.
Yeah, you found the sweet spot of the speakers for frequency response as well.
Yeah, maybe I have, but and I've also it's also like a personal calibration. I found a calibration for me where I know, if it's not if it's supposed to be raucous and it's not raucous at that volume, I know that I need to do more work, or if it's supposed to be warm and subby, but it's,
Do you have any favorite plugins that you tend to use?
I've just gone nuts for Plugin Alliance, actually. It's another subscription model. It's a new discovery for me. I mean, obviously, like everyone, I'm a huge UAD fan. I've got, massive. I've got a great relationship with UAD, and I'm a huge admirer of their work. But the Plugin Alliance, the whole. I mean, I'm still exploring it. I'm enjoying that very much. I mean, I've got it's like you know, like every, I've just got so many plugins. I don't know. It's just ridiculous, really. I've got my friends in Poland, PSP. I've been an early adopter. I love their saturation modeling, the InfiniStrip that they just made. I really like. They just added saturation to it. I'm excited to try that tomorrow. I haven't tried the saturation module in their InfiniStrip. Yeah, great guys, as well. And I've been with them forever because I was a very early adopter of Vintage Warmer, which was one of the early real saturators in digital. I was like, oh, this is great,
That's my favorite. It's on my mix bus every single time, almost.
There you go. There you go. I mean, that's their magic. And I love the great, the great. I mean, RX is an indispensable tool, has to be said. I mean, we've all got access to the same tools now. It's amazing, and we're all working in the same 24-bit high window, whatever it is. It's a very interesting times.
But it's funny, the playing field has leveled in that regards. So what you then hear is the creativity without having any of the other stuff in the way, so to speak.
Yeah, and that's what's wonderful about the digital revolution, isn't it? It gives a lot of. I mean, obviously, it's not. It means you can be massively creative without having to get the money to go into Capitol Records to make your record, to finish your mix or something. And it does, and it's sobering, really, because it does throw the ball back in our court and say, well, it's up to you, really. That you've got all the tools at your disposal. Do your best, mate.
Last question, Garrett. What's the best piece of business advice that maybe somebody imparted to you, or maybe you learned along the way?
Well, apart from the obvious of getting the invoice in early and doing your taxes, that's like really super important. A long time ago, as simple as, and it applies in life as well as business, I suppose I would say, if you say, if you commit to doing something, then do it. And what happened to me a very long time ago, someone phoned me up and asked me to do something, and I said yes on the Friday. And on the, I was living in Germany at the time. The Germans are very correct about business, I feel, and which is a good thing. I learned a lot from my time in Germany. And on Monday, I thought, oh, that was a bit cheap, what I said to him. And on Monday, I phoned him back and said, look, man, this is not really worth. And he said, but we agreed though on Friday. And that kind of stuck with me. I can't even remember the project or the man's name, but it kind of stuck. I thought, actually, man, we made an agreement, just like you and I, we said, we'll chat at 10 p.m. European time. You know what? We both showed up. I think that's hugely important in business. If we say we're going to do something, let's just do it.
Thanks for listening and being in my inner circle. Remember, if you have any questions or comments, you can send them to questions at bobbyosinski.com. To listen to other episodes of Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle, go to bobbyosinski.com and select the podcast tab, or go to bobbyownercircle.com, or you can find it on iTunes, Stitcher, Mixcloud, Google Podcasts, Spotify, Deezer, TuneIn Radio, Radio Public, and Podbean. At bobbyosinski.com and bobbyownercircle.com, you'll also find a sign-up form for my newsletter and for alerts for new podcasts. This is Bobby Osinski. I will see you next time.